Lecture 25, Northwestern University, Materials Science and Engineering 405, Physics of Solids, Professor Mark Persom, November 7th, 2006.
Okay, let's get started. Last time we were going through the Kronig-Penney model, and we had gotten to the following point in the analysis. P divided by kappa A sine kappa A plus cosine kappa A was equal to cosine Ka. Remember, kappa is a function of energy. Energy is h bar squared kappa squared over 2m. Furthermore, we recognize that the right-hand side of this equation is a cosine function, and as a result, it can only exist for values between 1 and minus 1. On the other hand, the left-hand side of this equation, as a function of kappa, can have values which exceed 1 and minus 1. And as a result, there will be some values of kappa which are not allowed. Furthermore, there will be values of kappa which are allowed. So there will be bands of allowed kappa and bands of unallowed or disallowed kappa. Kappa is directly related to energy, and as a result, this implies the formation of energy bands and energy band gaps. So to be more explicit, let me write down that since the absolute value of cosine Ka is less than or equal to 1, only certain bands of kappa and therefore energy, which is equal to h bar squared kappa squared over 2m, are allowed. To best understand this equation here, I find it easiest to look at a graph of it. So let's look at a plot. And this plot will show us that we can calculate precisely what the bands are, what the band gaps are. And in undergraduate solid state, I have students calculate these numbers. If it's not obvious how to do that, you should probably think about it. We can talk about it in office hours if you want. But figure 5 is the plot that I was referring to. This is the left-hand side of the equation we just wrote down. As you can see, this function P over kappa A sine kappa A plus cosine kappa A certainly has regions which exceed 1 and minus 1, plotted as a function of kappa A. The right-hand side of the equation is equal to cosine Ka, and as a result, it has to be between 1 and minus 1 for there to be a solution. And so we see that there are regions, which are in this case highlighted dark gray, where kappa is not allowed. And as a result, that would represent the energy band gaps. And you can see that the first band gap occurs right here. There's a second one there, a third one there, etc. We can also see that there are regions where there are allowed bands of energy. And those would exist, for example, right there, 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 etc. Now, the question is, how do we relate these energy bands to K? Remember, K is on the right-hand side of this equation, cosine Ka. So, for example, if K were 0, then cosine Ka would be 1. And the first time that we would encounter that would be at this location here. So this location here represents where K is equal to 0. We then continue to increase K. The next critical value for K will be when K equals pi over A. Cosine pi over A times A is cosine pi, which is negative 1. And as a result, this region here, or this point here, would represent the top of the band, which occurs at K equals pi over A, the Brillouin zone boundary, as we argued qualitatively using Bragg reflection. Interestingly, we see that there are two values allowed at K equals pi over A. As expected, we get a splitting and an opening of an energy band gap. And if we were to calculate the value of kappa there and the value of kappa there, we can then calculate the values of energy at those two locations using h bar squared kappa squared over 2m. Take the difference of those two, and that would tell us the band gap energy in electron volts at K equals pi over A. You could then go further Eventually, the next critical point would be 2 pi over a. And at 2 pi over a, we would again be at the top of a band. We'd see the opening of a band gap. So we could say the band gap at 2 pi over a is equal to the difference in energy at that value of kappa and that value of kappa, and so on. And as a result, you can take this and calculate for each value of k what the value of kappa is from this plot. When you show that value of kappa, you can create a value of energy and then plot energy versus k. And that's figure 6. Plot of energy versus wave number. And we can see that there are these regions of allowed energy and then band gaps which open up at values of kA equal to pi, 2 pi, 3 pi, etc. Another thing you'll notice is that the slope of the EK relationship goes to 0 at the band edges. Again, something that we're expected to see. And now we've been able to prove quantitatively using Kronig-Penney model. Of course, reciprocal lattice is periodic, and so you can fold everything back into the first Brillouin zone and plot this in the reduced zone scheme, producing the exact same qualitative plot that we generated using Bragg reflection. So if you understand how you get from the top graph to the bottom graph, you understand everything there is to know about Kronig-Penney. Is it obvious or unclear to anybody? Okay. Like I said, if you get this, that's all there is to Kronig-Penney. Kronig-Penney is very enticing from a professor's perspective for exam problems because it's very simple. You can do things analytically. There's lots of tricks you can play. So you should probably understand Kronig-Penney pretty well. Okay. But what I want to talk about today is not Kronig-Penney, but in direct response to the very good question we had last time, and that is, how many periods do we really need to start to see band structure? We had to create this artificial construct last time that the lattice folded back on itself as it went around a ring. We created this pseudo-infinite periodic potential in that way. And that is clearly not the case. If you're going along the length of a crystal and you get to this end, you're not going back to the other side, right? A solid is not a ring. And so is that artificial boundary condition we put in Kronig-Penney somehow artificially creating band structure? Or is band structure really something which we would expect to find in any solid? If it is a real phenomenon, then what you'd expect to do is if you built up a solid one atom at a time, you should start to see that solid go from discrete atoms, which we know have discrete energy levels, into a band structure, which has allowed energies and unallowed band gaps. And so the procedure we're going to develop over the next 2 days will allow us to build up band structure one atom at a time. It's an extremely powerful approach, and you can apply it to a wide range of problems, particularly relevant to nanoscale science and technology, where you tend to have confined systems. Okay. This whole approach is taken from an article that Griffiths wrote in the American Journal of Physics in 2001, and I put a copy of that on the webpage if you want to read it. The approach is general in that not only does it apply to quantum mechanical waves, but to any wave. You can describe locally periodic potentials which would interact with acoustic waves, electromagnetic waves, elastic waves. This analysis is perfectly general, and Griffiths gives you dozens of examples applying this to all aspects of physics. We'll, of course, focus on the quantum mechanical application of this approach. So to put this in context, let's review what we've done thus far in this course. Thus far, we have studied 3 types of wave motion. The first were traveling waves. And if you recall, for example, for the free particle, which is the first solution of the Schrodinger equation that we did, we found that these traveling waves can have any frequency. And what this implied is a continuous value for k. And as a result, when we did this, we had to generate wave packets and come up with some prefactor phi, which told us the amplitude of this continuous variable k. These traveling waves can have any frequency. And in quantum mechanics, you'll see these as scattering states. All the scattering states had no constraints put on the frequencies of these traveling waves. So that's one case. The second case, for example, a particle in a box, we found that there were standing waves. And we found that when we have confinement in quantum mechanics, that implies that only discrete energies are allowed, and therefore these standing waves can only occur for discrete or quantized allowed frequencies. And any bound state in quantum mechanics will lead to this quantization of energy and therefore a discrete number of allowed frequencies. So that's the second case that we looked at. The third case, which we've now looked at, which is Kroning-Penney model, is that of waves interacting with an infinite periodic media. And here we saw that there's something in between these two. Clearly, not all frequencies are allowed, nor are there only discrete allowed frequencies, but there are bands of continuous allowed frequencies. So frequencies fall into continuous bands, which is very similar to a traveling wave, but they're separated by forbidden gaps. And this would be, for example, Kroning-Penney. And the last one is arguably the most important for solid-state physics because we have something which appears infinitely periodic. But the question is, what is infinite? Is it 10 to the 23rd? Is it 10? Is it 500? We're going to be able to answer that question quantitatively using this approach. Okay. So the question which I posed today, and we'll answer over the next couple days, is what about finite, locally periodic media? And I want to point out that locally periodic media is not only important for nanoscale materials, but many macroscopic materials will have regions where there's nanoscale variations in the properties. For example, almost all metals will have grain boundaries whose dimensions are on the nanometer scale. And they'll have a local periodicity which is different from that of the bulk resulting from that grain boundary. So this is quite general and useful to all of material science. And so it's worth the effort. It will take a couple days. The math, it's not too bad, but it's extremely elegant, this approach, and very flexible. So before we can answer that question, we need to first come up with a matter of dealing with scattering from a single period in a general way, which could then be generalized to n periods. So we'll first consider scattering from an arbitrary potential. So we want to develop a strategy which will work for any locally periodic potential. We talked a lot about analyzing scattering for specific potentials. We did delta functions, we did finite potential wells, infinite potential wells, harmonic oscillator, etc. But how about for an arbitrary potential? So we'll sketch this. The potential we'll say exists between A and B and is zero everywhere else, and we'll have some shape. Arbitrary potential. If we were to describe the scattering problem, we'd describe an incoming wave from the left, which would be AE to the IKX. There would be a reflected wave, which would be BE to the negative IKX. We'd, of course, have a transmitted wave, C, e to the IKX. And in principle, if we wanted to consider the opposite problem, that is a wave incident from the right onto the potential, moving to the left, we could have a third, which would be D e to the negative IKX. This is completely general. We don't know a priori which way the incident wave is coming from. So we'll include both possibilities. We can then write down the general solution. General solution psi would therefore be equal to a sum of the leftward and rightward propagating waves, that is a e to the I kx plus b e to the negative I kx for all values of x less than a. We're going to have the solution to the Schrodinger equation for this potential. Of course, the details of the potential would dictate the details of this solution. I'm just going to call it psi sub a b, which will be some function of x within the region of space where the potential is non-zero. And then to the right of the potential, we'll of course have the sum of leftward and rightward propagating waves. That is c e to the I kx plus d e to the negative I kx for x greater than b, where we know that k is equal to the square root of 2me over h bar. And as a result, what we would do to complete this problem you solve the Schrodinger equation for a less than x less than b. And then invoke appropriate boundary conditions at x equals a and x equals b. So we know the routine. We could do this if I told you what the potential was. And what this approach will yield is two linear relations among the coefficients A, B, C, and D. And of course, we did this many times. And then what we had to do to get around this problem that we didn't have enough equations, right? We have two equations and four unknowns. What we did is we assumed it was only coming from one direction, so we got rid of D. And then we divided everything through by A. We normalized it to just get the reflection and transmission coefficients. That's what we did before. What we're doing today is making this completely general. We're just going to deal with the fact that we don't have enough equations, and yet we're still going to be able to make progress. Later on, we'll use those tricks we did before. We'll let d go to 0 and then take the ratio of everything with respect to a. Okay. So this is what it yields. And as a result, for this analysis, it is convenient to express A and B in terms of C and D. And we can do this succinctly, writing it in matrix notation. So we're going to say the 2x1 matrix AB will be given by some matrix M. So I'm depicting matrices as this bracketed symbol M, which will be a 2x2 matrix times the matrix 2x1 matrix CD. Where M is a 2x2 matrix, and I'm going to label each element in this matrix in terms of its row and column. So the upper left-hand corner would be row 1, column 1, so capital M1, 1, capital M1, 2, capital M21 and capital M22. In this matrix, we call the transfer matrix. It's going to transfer the waves from the left-hand side to the right-hand side. So it connects the two regions in space. The beauty of this is that now if we add a second period and we create a new transfer matrix for that next period, we can just multiply those matrices together to connect together this region in space to that region in space. We'll do this n times, capital N times, where n is the number of periods in the periodic potential. And so you're going to get a matrix which is raised to the nth power, and the problem will reduce to calculating the nth power of a 2x2 matrix. So it's very general. In a real problem, what you would do is you'd look at the details of the potential to determine what these values are for the transfer matrix that would come out of the solution of the Schrodinger equation and the application of the boundary conditions. And once you have that, you simply do the calculational approach that we're going to be developing over the next day or so. Okay. Is everybody comfortable with the transfer matrix? As I said, it's extremely powerful. Professor Lahan actually asked me to introduce this in 405 because he uses the same analysis in his course on metamaterials. Metamaterials is another great example of where you'll have local periodicity and will influence optical properties, for example, of photonic bandgap materials. That'll fall directly out of the same analogous analysis for electromagnetic waves in that case as opposed to quantum mechanical wave functions, which we're doing today. Okay. So let's talk about the transfer matrix. There's some tricks we can utilize to simplify the analysis. Right now we have to find four terms to complete the transfer matrix. We can reduce this down to only two terms by exploiting two properties which are true for the Schrodinger equation. So let's do that analysis. We can impose strong conditions on the transfer matrix by recognizing two general properties of the Schrodinger equation. The first property is so-called time reversal invariance. Okay, what am I talking about? Time reversal invariance. Well, let's go back to basics. Let's write down the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, as I did on the first day of this course. If you recall, it has the following form. Minus h bar squared over 2m, second partial with respect to x, capital psi, which of course is both spatial and temporal dependence, plus v. And the only thing we assume is that v is real and time independent. Times capital psi will be equal to I h bar partial with respect to t times capital psi, or operating on capital psi. Whereas I said, we'll assume that v is time independent and real. So this analysis only applies to time-independent real potentials. Of course, those are the only ones which are relevant for 95% of solid-state physics. Okay, so what does this time reversal invariance mean? Well, what I want to do is now take the complex conjugate of the Schrodinger equation and reverse time. That is, replace t with minus t. And let's see what we get. The first term here, if we took the complex conjugate, of course, minus h bar squared over 2m is real. And then we would have the second derivative of the complex conjugate of psi, but now we're replacing t with minus t. So kinetic energy becomes this. The next term, if we took the complex conjugate, since v is real, this remains unchanged. But the second term, of course, will now be the complex conjugate, capital psi star of x, and again, we're replacing t with minus t. This will be equal to IH bar partial with respect to T psi star x minus T. Where what we've done is taken the complex conjugate, so IH bar will become negative IH bar, but T becomes minus T, so the two negative signs cancel. And if we look at these two equations, we see that they're exactly the same. They're exactly the same. This term here, minus h bar squared over 2m, second partial with respect to x, is the same. V is the same, and ih bar partial with respect to t is the same. So this is the exact same form as the original time-dependent Schrodinger equation. So from the perspective of a mathematician, this is the same form as the time-dependent Schrodinger equation. And as a result, if capital Psi is a solution, then so is Psi star of x, comma minus t. And as a result, it's known as time reversal invariance, because if we reverse time, we see that the wave function undergoes a complex conjugate. But of course, it matters physically. It's not the wave function, but the magnitude squared of the wave function. So the magnitude squared of the wave function is exactly the same for forward progressing time or backwards progressing time. And this has some deep philosophical implications, and science fiction writers will use this as justification for time travel and things like this, which we will not be discussing in class. What we're going to use, though, is that this is in fact the case. And so what it tells us is we know what psi looks like, and as a result, we know that psi star is also a solution. So we can just write that solution down. So psi star of x is a solution. It's just a complex conjugate of the original solution. So it will be a star times e to the negative ikx plus b star e to the ikx for x less than a. It'll be psi star between a and b, which will be determined from the Schrodinger equation as a function of x in the region where the potential is non-zero. And in the final region in space, we'll get the complex conjugate, which becomes c star e to the negative I kx plus d star e to the I kx. And that will be true for x greater than b. Now, what this does is it reverses the direction of the incoming and outgoing waves. Right, the complex conjugate changes the sign of the exponent. And as a result, the waves which were before going to the left are now going to the right. And as a result, we can now express the transfer matrix in a new form, utilizing this new solution of the Schrodinger equation. Okay. So physically, this exchanges incoming and outgoing waves. And as a result, we now have that the top term in our transfer matrix equation, instead of being A, is B star, because that's now the wave which is proceeding to the right. The bottom term becomes A star. This will still be equal to the same transfer matrix, right? The transfer matrix is the same. And it has four terms as before. But now the outward going wave changes direction, so we're going to have D star and C star. What this allows us to do is now multiply out this matrix equation, and it tells us that B star will be equal to M11 D star plus M12 C star, We can take the complex conjugate of both sides of this equation, and it implies that B equals M1 star D plus M12 star times C. We can execute the second row of this matrix multiplication. And therefore, A star becomes M21 D star plus M22 C star. Again, taking the complex conjugate of both sides of this equation, we find a new relationship for A. A is equal to M21 star times D plus M22 star times C. And as a result, we now have a new expression relating matrix AB with CD, utilizing this new relationship that we just derived. And as a result, we can write this series of two equations in the following form, that AB will be equal to M22 star, M21 star, M12 star, M11 star, times CD. But we previously developed a relationship between AB and CD, which was just a transfer matrix which went M11, M12, M21, M22. And as a result, we can see by inspection that this matrix here has to equal the previous transfer matrix that we derived. And as a result, M11, M12, M21, M22 is equal to the new form that we've derived, M22 star, M21 star, M12 star, M11 star. And so by inspection, we can see that this puts some constraints now on the elements of the transfer matrix. In particular, we see that M11 has to equal M22 star. And M21 has to equal M12 star. So it tells you that the diagonal terms in the transfer matrix are complex conjugates of one another. Both of the diagonals are the same in that respect. Okay. So we simplified the problem. In particular, if we knew what M11 was and M21 was, we immediately know what M12 and M22 are. So we don't have to do the whole problem. We can do half the problem. This is a direct consequence of time reversal invariance of the Schrodinger equation. Everybody comfortable with these constraints? Okay. The second principle we're going to employ to simplify the analysis is conservation of probability. If you had read chapter one of Griffiths carefully, you would have seen this statement being developed. And we're going to exploit it at this point. In particular, in quantum mechanics, in one dimension, you can define a so-called probability current, and you utilize this probability current to calculate the tunneling current, for example, in a scanning tunneling microscope or a resonant tunneling diode. The probability current is equal to J, and it's given by H bar over 2mi times psi star d psi dx minus d psi star dx psi. And what's important in quantum mechanics in one dimension is that the probability current is independent of x. Okay, so probability current is constant everywhere. And as a result, this tells us that if we were to evaluate J for values of x less than a, this would be equal to values of J for x greater than b. And of course, we have forms of the Schrodinger of the wave function in those three regions of space which are distinct from one another. And this relationship here should now give us some relationship between A, B, and C, D, an additional constraint, which will simplify the analysis. So what we're going to do now is take both psi and psi star, which we have a general form of, plug it into this equation, and see where it leads us. And we'll find that it's going to put some serious constraints, further constraints, on the transfer matrix. And these constraints are very important in developing the next step in the theory, which is looking at a periodic, locally periodic media. Okay, so let's do this. Let's calculate now J for x less than A. This will be equal to H bar over 2mi times, if we take the complex conjugate of psi. Complex conjugate of psi, we know, in the region of x less than A is A star e to the negative ikx plus B star e to the ikx. So that's going to be multiplied with d psi dx. Both terms have terms which go as e to the ikx or e to the negative ikx. When we take the derivative, the ik term will come out in front. So we'll get ik times A e to the ikx minus B e to the negative ikx, where the minus sign comes from the negative sign in the exponent, which will come out in front when you take the derivative. This will be subtracted from the spatial derivative of psi star. The spatial derivative will also have a common term ik times b star e to the ikx minus a star e to the negative ikx. This will be multiplied by psi, and we know psi is simply equal to a e to the ikx plus b e to the negative ikx. And so we have to execute these products. One thing you notice is that the ik term is constant or is shared by both terms, so we can pull it out in front of this equation. And so this is just equal to h bar k over 2m. The first term will just be equal to magnitude squared of a. The second term will be plus a b star e to the 2i kx minus b a star e to the negative I, negative 2i kx minus b squared. Now move on to the second product. The first term here will be negative a b star e to the 2i kx plus magnitude squared of a squared minus magnitude squared of b squared plus b a star e to the negative 2i kx. Fortunately for us, all the terms which have a spatial dependence cancel, as expected. In addition, we have two terms of a squared, two terms of negative b squared. So we can write the probability current pulling the 2, common factor of 2, out in front as h bar k over m times magnitude squared of a minus magnitude squared of b. Now, the analysis for the region of x greater than b is identical, except now we have coefficients of c and d, but everything else is identical. And as a result, we can say similarly, j for x greater than b, without doing any calculation, is clearly h bar k over m times magnitude squared of c minus magnitude squared of d. And as a result, conservation of probability tells us that j for x less than a is equal to j of x greater than b, which implies that the magnitude squared of a minus magnitude squared of b will be equal to magnitude squared of c minus magnitude squared of d, where the term h bar k over m is equal on both sides of the equation can be canceled. Okay, so this is a series of constraints, but we want to relate it back to m. So we're going to do that by writing this equation here in matrix notation. So in matrix notation, this constraint here can be written in the following form. A 1 by 2 matrix AB times a 2 by 2 matrix 1, 0, 0, minus 1 times a 2 by 1 matrix A star B star. So if you're to multiply this 3, you'd get out magnitude squared of A squared minus magnitude squared of B squared. This will be equal to, on the right-hand side, the same form, CD, 1, 0, 0, minus 1, C star, D star. And the reason why I've written it in this way is that we have a relationship which relates AB to CD via the transfer matrix. So what we want to do is express this in terms of the transfer matrix and that in terms of the transfer matrix. And so if you're comfortable with matrix mathematics, this is obvious. If you're not comfortable with it, you can always just multiply it out and confirm that what I'm saying is in fact the case. The term on the right side, that is A star B star, is easy. So you just take the complex conjugate of both sides of the transfer matrix equation. The other side, AB, is a little bit trickier. You have to take the transpose of the matrix, which is the trick from linear algebra. It's not that bad in this case to double check it if you don't know how to take the transpose. So I'll just write down the result. So you want to substitute in the transfer matrix to the left-hand side of the first matrix equation there. And as a result, AB will come CD times M11, M21, M12, M22. And like I said, this is where I've exploited the transpose. And if it's not obvious, go ahead and multiply it out. You'll see that it's equal to AB. Then it's going to be multiplied by this connecting matrix, 1, 0, 0, minus 1. And then A star B star will replace the complex conjugate of the second equation. So that will become M11 star, M12 star, M21 star, M22 star, times C star D star. This will be equal to the right-hand side of the equation, which is CD, 1, 0, 0, minus 1, C star, D star. And if you look at these two equations, you see that this matrix here has to equal the product of these three matrices. And as a result, this implies that M12, M22, times 1, 0, 0, minus 1, times M11 star, M12 star, M21 star, M22 star is simply equal to 1, 0, 0, minus 1. So what we want to do is now execute this 2 by 2 times 2 by 2 matrix multiplication twice. We'll do it in two steps. The first step, we'll do this multiplication. And so the term on the left-hand side stays the same. It's M11, M21, M12, M22. We're now going to multiply these two together. And what we'll get out is M11 star, M12 star, negative M21 star, negative M22 star. And the right-hand side, of course, stays the same. We then have one more matrix multiplication to do. So let's execute that. This one's a little messier because we have all eight elements present in the matrix. What we'll get out is M11 magnitude squared minus M21 magnitude squared. For the second element, we'll get M11, M12 star, minus M21, M22 star. For the second row, we'll get M11 star, M12, minus M22, M21 star. And finally, M12 magnitude squared minus M22 magnitude squared. And this will be equal to the right-hand side, which remains the same, 1, 0, 0, minus 1. Because what this gives us now is four more constraints between the four matrix elements. While there are four new constraints here, only one of them is unique in light of our previous constraints that we developed. So in light of our previous constraints, which we determined from time reversal invariance, let me remind you of those, i.e. M11 equals M22 star and M21 equals M12 star. This matrix equation yields one additional constraint. In particular, M11 magnitude squared minus M21 magnitude squared equals 1. And if it's not obvious, go ahead and plug in these new constraints and you'll see that there's nothing else here that we don't already know. Okay. As a result, if we let M11 to be equal to some complex number W, and M12 be equal to some different complex number Z, we can see from these three constraints that the transfer matrix M has to be of the following form. We said the matrix diagonals are complex conjugates. So if that's W, then this has to be W star. And if that's Z, that has to be Z star, such that the magnitude squared of W minus the magnitude squared of Z is equal to 1. That's our final constraint. So this transfer matrix form will be true for any potential, as long as it's real and time independent. And so the first step in any problem that would be given to you is to take that potential V, which of course will vary from problem to problem, and determine what W and Z are. Once you know W and Z are, you can fill in the entire matrix. And in some cases where you can't figure out everything about Z, you can take advantage of this additional constraint that magnitude squared of W minus magnitude squared of Z. Oops. Is equal to 1. So you have an additional constraint which you can pull out of your bag of tricks when trying to determine what W and Z are. Once you have W and Z, then you'll be able to connect together the two sides of your potential. What we'll do next time is then say, what if we had, instead of just one potential, 2, 3, 4, up to some value, capital N. We have to employ the transfer matrix, capital N times, to connect together the left-hand side all the way to the right-hand side. And that'll just be a series of matrix multiplications. And as a result, we're going to have to raise the matrix to the capital N power. And I'll show you how that is done. We're going to have to pull out some polynomials known as Chebyshev polynomials of the second kind. Fortunately, those can be written very succinctly as a ratio of sine functions. And as a result, you can write down in literally three lines what the solution will be for any arbitrary potential which has capital N periods. And then in class, I'll show you this result for some relevant potentials for solid state physics. And we'll see the band structure will emerge with as few as 5 atoms, become very apparent for about 25 atoms. And obviously, in the limit of 10 to the 23rd atoms, there should be no doubt in our minds that band structure is real and leads to continuous value of energies for all practical purposes within those bands, the only constraint being that we have quantization, which results from the finite density of states, which exists for any three-dimensional material. Okay? So we'll complete that analysis next time. Thanks.
MSE 405.